Our next speaker is Joseph McNamara. Joe is a research fellow at the Hoover Institution. He was the chief of police for the city of San Jose, California, and before that, Kansas City, Missouri. He has had published articles in the New York Times, the Los Angeles Times, the Washington Post, the Wall Street Journal. He's been a commentator on NPR and has appeared on many TV programs, including 60 Minutes, Meet the Press, and so forth. He's currently completing work on a new book called Gangster Cops, on the issue of the corruption of law enforcement as a result of the drug war. I'm very pleased to introduce Joe McNamara.
Thank you very much. I'd like to share with you an email that I received today from my friend Ethan, a news release from some news agency regarding tonight's meeting, saying that one of the speakers would be retired police chief Ethan Nadelman. Now, I've known Ethan for some 15 years as a brilliant academic, a drug reformer, and so on. I never knew he was with the secret police. And whether it was the DEA or the FBI or the CIA, it's mind-boggling. I had these bizarre visions of him out on hunting trips with Dick Cheney and Ashcroft and others. So I'll leave Ethan to defend himself from that vision. I'd like to follow a rather simple theme with you, that there are roughly a million police officers in the United States and some 17,000 or so different police agencies. And so one needs to be somewhat cautious in generalizing, but there is such a thing as the police culture. And I would like to make the point with you that the police culture nurtures the drug war, and that the police culture has been greatly influenced by the federal escalation of the drug war. I don't think it's particularly useful for those of us who wish to change the current drug laws and think that they're wrongheaded to bash politicians and to bash the police, because after all, politicians want to get reelected, and the theory of democracy is that they do what the voters want, they get reelected. And the police have a duty to follow in a democracy the policies set by civilians. Otherwise, we have a police state. So I'd like to say that I think in terms of looking at this issue of the drug war and its escalation and the terrible problems that it has caused, to approach it a little bit from a different perspective. I'd like to first talk about this police culture. Most of the police officers, the overwhelming majority, are from working class backgrounds. And they enter police work for a variety of reasons, but most of them because they see it as a positive occupation in which they're the good guys. They're protecting the citizens from criminals, and that they're doing good. The first thing that happens after they're sworn in is they swear an oath of allegiance to the Constitution. But it's not the same Constitution that the ACLU sees or that a law professor sees. Very quickly, the police agencies have to change the recruits from civilians into police officers. Now, I think we Americans, it's safe to say, have a natural tendency to mind our own business. That has to be drilled out of the police recruits. They have to be trained to interfere, and sometimes with the activities of others, to be nosy, to be suspicious. And almost every police agency that I've ever seen sees themselves as crime fighters. They are the ones that prevent crime. They do so by arresting people that commit crimes and taking them out of circulation through the court system, or the fact that the threat of an arrest deters others from committing crimes. So if you keep that in mind and think about the training the police begin with, I was fortunate when I joined the New York City Police Department that in my particular class of some 600 recruits, we were broken into groups of 30, and we had a very good instructor, a real street smart sergeant who had integrity and was also a good teacher. And the lesson plan of the New York City Police Academy for what was then the most advanced training of any police agency in the United States, a four-month training course in which some 10% of the recruits didn't make it, had great impact by the ACLU, the NAACP, other community groups. And so each instructor worked from a prepared lesson plan. And when our sergeant taught us about the Fourth Amendment, which prohibits the police from making searches generally without a warrant, although there are some exceptions, he went through the lesson plan as it was written. However, a couple of days later, when he was teaching a course on police procedures from another lesson plan, he taught us how to search people. And there was a certain contradiction there, and being a kind of maverick even back in those days, and he being a reasonable man, unlike some of the other instructors, I asked the question, well, but what about the Fourth Amendment? I thought we weren't supposed to search people unless we had a warrant. And he said, well, that's just a civil matter. Someone can sue you for violating their civil rights, but you go ahead and search them. And no jury is going to find against a cop who comes up with a handful of dope outside the schoolyard. And if the courts didn't want us to do this, they wouldn't let us do it. Now, this was a good instructor. So that's the indoctrination that comes in. The Constitution is not seen as a glorious document that established unique civil rights in the history of civilization, but it's seen by the police as an obstacle that they have to get around to do their job. Now, let me say one other thing about the police culture. The police officers very soon see a slice of life that you don't see. They see misery, violence, human cruelty. They're thrown problems with emotionally disturbed people that they can't solve, that no one can solve. They see children horribly mutilated. They see violence, great deal of violence. In fact, the dark angel of death sits just behind the police officer's shoulder throughout their entire career, and it influences the way they see life very greatly. And also the police officers know full well that someone who's not a police officer just doesn't see this chaos, doesn't see the results of our society and poverty and other problems that they see, and oftentimes will not be able to judge a police officer's actions the way the police themselves think it should be judged. As a result of this, the danger, the physical danger, which is very real, and the legal danger that they may be charged falsely with a crime of using unnecessary force, they may be injured or so on, the police bind together in a rather unique way. And we've all heard of the code of silence, and it actually exists. It's one of the things in the police organization that is a very important fact of life. We don't have very many whistleblowers among the police for good reason, because the police feel they have to stick together. They're often the only witnesses that will support their actions, and that if they are seen by their fellow officers as a whistleblower, they're ostracized. And if they need help on the street, other police not only don't respond, but sometimes will jam their radio calls for help. And so if you want a police career, you don't get the idea in your head that it's advanced by reporting the misconduct of other police officers. Certainly that's not unique to the police. There are many other groups. In fact, some people say politicians even have the same view of life, and attorneys and doctors and others who feel threatened sometimes by false accusations. But I'd like to talk about the value systems by which the reward systems and the value systems by which the police operate. As a young officer, we walked foot patrol by ourselves. There were no portable radios in those days, no bulletproof vests or anything like that. And I worked in Harlem. One day I turned the corner and I saw a crowd a block away, and we had been trained in the police academy to be curious and to pay attention to such things. And as I approached the crowd, I saw a body on the ground, and suddenly the crowd split open and a man ran. I ran and I caught him, and I made my very first arrest as a police officer. It was for first degree murder. It was very unusual for a uniformed officer to make an arrest for murder, especially a foot patrol officer, and especially not in response to a call. It was made on observation. And one of the things that happened was I was immediately praised for this arrest and interviewed for appointment to the Detective Bureau, which was rather astounding because I had been walking a beat for a couple of months. I didn't have any real clear idea of how to be a cop, let alone how to be a detective. I often approached situations that would be bewildering on the street, and I'd listen to people yelling and screaming, and I'd say to myself, what would a real cop do in this situation? And so the idea of being a detective didn't have a lot of appeal to me. But the captain called me into the office and he said, that was a good pinch that you made. Now, if I had turned the corner a couple of minutes earlier and stopped the two men from fighting, the man would have lived, the victim would have lived, and the NYPD would have given a great big yawn. But because the man died and I arrested the perpetrator, then I was recognized. And you have to understand that that's the way police departments work. The captain, however, gave me a promotion. He put me on radio motor patrol, which was wonderful. It was very exciting, and you went from one assignment to another. You saw more in a year on radio motor patrol in Harlem than the average police officer saw during a 20-year career in most areas of the country. But the captain said something very puzzling to me. He said, I was, after all, 22 years old. As you can see, I'm not the tallest policeman you ever met, and in fact, just made the minimum height that existed in those days. And I looked like I was about 16 years old. And the captain looked at me and he said, one thing about this detective interview, keep in mind that a kid like you with a baby face will be stuck. They'll stick you right into the narcotic squad. And it was puzzling to me because many officers would have sold their soul to get the detective badge and the prestige that went with the detective assignment. I saw myself as rising up through the superior officer ranks, which in fact I eventually did. But it took some 10 years before I understood what the captain was warning me about. 10 years or so later, the New York State Investigation Commission found massive corruption in the New York City Narcotics Department. And I received my interview for the Detective Division in 1957. Detectives, narcotic detectives, had been robbing drug dealers, stealing the drugs and the money, selling the drugs back into the street, committing all such sorts of other crimes. Scores of detectives were arrested and sent to prison. A couple of them committed suicide. The investigation involved officers up to the rank of lieutenant, which was a pretty high rank. And so even that far back, the corruption was there in drug work. Why? Well, that's an involved question, involved many complexities. On motor patrol one day, my partner and I arrested a heroin addict on the top floor landing of what we called shooting galleries, the tenement top floor. And the addict that day had possession of a hypodermic needle and a little cooker in which he had just heated up his heroin, mixed with water, and injected it. Now, there was no usable heroin left in this bottle cap, but we would send it to the police lab and it would come back with a residue of heroin, which was possession of heroin, punishable by 6 months in jail, as was the hypodermic needle. Why would we make those kind of arrests? Because the police department wanted us to. And if you wanted to ride in a police car, you had better show sufficient activity. And not only that, the captain gave you a day off for making an incredibly minor arrest like that of a pathetic, hardcore addict. This day, the addict said, "Officer, give me a break," as I handcuffed him. And I said, "Yeah, sure," you know, because we weren't paid to give breaks to people that were committing these kind of crimes. My partner, who was senior to me and ordinarily more sensible, I was the cop who loved to throw on the siren and the red light and race through the streets and drive on the sidewalk. And we were always the first car on the scene of a robbery when I was driving. When he drove, we were the last car on the scene. But of course, he was married and had three children. But this day, he went along with the addict, and the deal was that the addict would give us a pusher. And that in return for that, we would let the addict go. We, quote, escape. And we were in police uniform in a marked police car. It was a warm day, and we traveled down Lenox Avenue following this heroin addict who we had warned, "Don't try to run away, because this guy," my partner pointed at me, "can run much faster than you, and we'll add a couple of more charges if you do that." So the addict was never more than a few feet from the police car because we stayed close to him. And as he walked along crowded streets, he talked to one man after another. And I suddenly felt very humiliated. I mean, after all, here we were resplendent with our uniforms, our radios, our red lights, our handcuffs, and our guns, and people were doing drugs a few feet away. They were doing drug deals. Otherwise, we would have looked at the men and thought they were talking about sports, the weather, or anything. There was no way of knowing what they were doing. It was a consensual activity between people who obviously valued their privacy, to put it mildly. And on the third conversation, the addict, as prearranged, went into the hallway to exchange money, which he didn't have, for drugs. We wandered in and sort of by accident arrested the pusher and let the addict, quote, escape. The pusher that we arrested was also an addict. He was selling small amounts of drugs just to finance his own habit. But what struck me that day is that the police really are totally ineffective in the normal police work against drug crimes. That this is probably occurring millions of times a day right under the nose of the police, and there's no way that they know about it. Now, when the police are pressured to make more arrests, as they have been by their own departments, but pushed very hard by the federal government. The federal government has taken over an incredible amount of police training, local police training in the United States. The police are subjected to a constant barrage of what I call propaganda. Drug users are evil, immoral people. This is your job, fighting good against evil, and so on. The difficulty of enforcing the drug laws as compared to, let's say, a robbery or a rape where there's a victim, there are witnesses, there's physical evidence, someone calls the police, there's a degree of community outrage, is the police don't know who's doing drugs unless they use very questionable methods. The detectives who were involved in the scandal had been...
He hasn't changed.
The DEA wants a new tape. I find the federal government does this to me wherever I speak, so it's no difficulty. I'll tell a couple of more jokes about Ethan while I'm waiting.
Okay, go ahead.
So when you put this pressure on the police, and understand that it comes from a number of different sources. I went to a lot of community meetings as police chief. And when you met with community groups, they wanted the police to stop drug selling and drug use in their neighborhood. They did not want to lecture on the constitutional law. They didn't want any excuses. Their view was, we want these drug pushers arrested. You know who they are, and trying to explain that we really didn't. And we want you to drive the drugs out of our neighborhood to protect our children. You can't dismiss this. This is a very valid concern for people who live in neighborhoods where there's an open drug market, and certainly of parents in general. And so the pressure is put on police in a number of ways. What I've been working on and have discovered in the last 9 years of my research is that the police brass sort of develops an attitude, and the federal government has really reinforced this attitude. Certainly their own agents have that attitude, that you can't handcuff the cops. When they go after drug pushers, the pushers use all sorts of subterfuges and so on, and so it takes extraordinary methods to use this. Now, at the same time, as was mentioned earlier, the country is still flooded with drugs. Back when I was a rookie, there used to be an occasional shortage of drugs when the feds made a big seizure and the price would temporarily go up. People would use other drugs as a substitute. Today, that doesn't occur anymore, and the police get demoralized. As a result of that, any number of police, I calculate that I've, in my research, have found more than 1 million police crimes committed in the drug war. Police officers, from uniformed officers to elite narcotic squads, committing murders, armed robberies, stealing drugs. I call them gangster cops. Instead of taking payoffs from gangsters, they are the gangsters. And this has been something spread throughout the country over 40 years. The reason for it is that you have modestly paid police officers who see it's hopeless. Their efforts have become hopeless. Many of them rationalize their crimes by saying, we can't do anything about it. Why should the enemy get to keep all the money? Within the last 2 weeks, New York has experienced yet another case of this involving at least 10 officers. Two detectives, veteran detectives, were observed by a team of federal officers who had a drug courier under surveillance robbing the courier. The investigation began from there, and they found each of the detectives had about $700,000 in cash in safe deposit box. And I found this over and over again, detectives, other cops stealing millions of dollars over a period of years in police agencies, and none of the other cops seemed to notice. Why? The code of silence, vested interests of mayors and police chief, of minimizing scandal, putting the spin on, it's only a few rotten apples. In fact, it often turns out to be the most decorated officers in the department. So I'm completing a book called Gangster Cops, The Hidden Cost of America's War on Drugs. It's been neglected as a national phenomenon because policing is so local, but it has been small towns to big cities, East Coast, Midwest, West Coast, patrolmen in uniform breaking into people's homes, committing armed robberies, to the chief or sheriff himself or herself. And this is a scandal that I think we have to make the public aware of. We have to make the police acknowledge this and recognize it as a cost of the drug war. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Joe.